The following Dharma talk was given by Danika Shoan Enkele Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shoan Sensei is a teacher in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered freely for the benefit of all.
From the Gateless Gate, case number 19, Ordinary Mind is Tao. Zhao Zhou once asked Nan Quan, "What is Tao?" Nan Quan answered, "Ordinary mind is Tao." "Then should we direct ourselves toward it or not?" asked Zhao Zhou. "If you try to direct yourself toward it, you go away from it," answered Nan Quan. Zhao Zhou continued, "If we do not try, how can we know that it is Tao?" Nan Quan replied, "Tao does not belong to knowing or to not knowing. Knowing is illusion. Not knowing is blankness. If you really attain to Tao of no doubt, it is like the great void, so vast and boundless. How then can there be right and wrong in the Tao?" At these words, Zhao Zhou was suddenly enlightened. Muman's commentary. Questioned by Zhao Zhou, Nan Quan immediately shows that the tile is disintegrating, the ice is dissolving, and no communication whatsoever is possible. Even though Zhao Zhou may be enlightened, he can truly get it only after studying for 30 more years. The verse. Hundreds of flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, and snow in winter. If there is no vain cloud in your mind, for you, it is a good season. I was asked what I would want to drink. And I thought, well, I'll have coffee and milk in homage to Daidoshi. But now my mouth is so dry. It's like the last thing that I want. Not bad. So, ordinary mind is Tao. I was thinking that in a way, it feels like the crux of this is the teaching that like brought me to Zen and has kept me in Zen all these years. How the Zen school really holds up and points to, in all these different ways, the very ordinary, everyday, the chopping wood and carrying water as examples of enlightened activity, cleaning toilets as an offering to the Buddhas and ancestors, eating oatmeal as an embodiment of profound truth. So many ways we can look and see how the training and the practice here are very much this unequivocal teaching that the path and the depth of the path and the fruit of the path and our peace of mind and our wisdom are all going to be found right here in the midst of our very ordinary lives. And obviously, I hope, at the same time, this kind of ordinary, you know, that Nan Quan is holding up is not our ordinary, if you will. This ordinary mind is definitely not the ordinary mind that we see on vivid display in our world, the mind driven by greed, anger, and ignorance, by anxiety and fear, riddled with distraction, steeped in depression. This is not that ordinary. And so I wanted to look at why is it pointed to as ordinary mind, and how can we practice in accord with this teaching. It's a question of what do we mean by ordinary? And I wanted to revisit an anecdote that I've shared before, but it's pretty irresistible to bring it up now. And this is from a number of years ago when I think Gokhan and I were both living at the temple with Shugen Roshi and just kind of helping run things day to day and very much in our discernment, our monastic discernment. And I went through all kinds of phases in my monastic discernment, and this was one of the low and crunchy phases. And I remember just starting to feel like, God, like the ordinary aspect, I was like making it felt like really ordinary, you know, like a lot of like cleaning and a lot of like doing the same thing every day. And I started to feel also like the pedestal that I put my teacher on was shape-shifting before my eyes. And I remember going into Doksan. I don't know if you remember this. I hope not. And I was kind of like, you know, I don't know, like full of steam and like, you know, this and this and this and this. And I said, you know, and you're just an ordinary person. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, that's right. But you don't yet know what ordinary is. Touché. That has really stayed with me. So what kind of ordinary is this? Well, before we enter in further, I wanted to just refresh our collective memories on who these really significant figures are in this koan. So this is Zhaozhou and Nanquan. You might recognize their Japanese pronunciation of their names, Joshu, right? As in Joshu's Mu, and Nansen, like Nansen kills the cat. So Joshu studied with Nanquan or Zhaozhou studied with Nanquan for decades, I think like maybe 30 years. But this particular exchange is right at the beginning of him meeting his teacher. And he was quite young. Apparently he had been a student of some kind, you know, studying and had left the scholarly realm and had journeyed quite far from his hometown in northern China to southern China to study. And Nanquan was a student of Master Matsu, who is really held up as an exceptional teacher. This is early-ish in the tradition, so it's like 8th century, and if you figure that Bodhidharma kind of is credited with establishing the Zen school in 6th century, you can see we're still pretty early on in Chan establishing itself, coming in to like, what is this school? What is it that like makes it its own thing? So, and one thing that's interesting about Nanquan is apparently he spent 30 years in solitary retreat after realizing himself with Master Matsu, and then eventually came down and established a monastery and began to attract disciples and gain a reputation. And one of the things that I think is like really essential is like, how do we make an exchange like this personal? And if we're a koan student, then that's really vital. And even if koans aren't our formal practice, you know, to be drawing on them for inspiration and gleaning what we can as sustenance for the road. And so how do we sort of, you know, not get trapped in the thought that this is like hundreds of years ago in ancient China, and kind of like bring ourselves into this exchange so that Zhao Zhou's question becomes an expression of our own question. That's how it's going to come alive. And so just to say, like, you can use, I give you permission to use your imagination in the ways that you need to make this personal. So for example, often when I would be working on a koan, I would take a little time with it where I would convert the characters to women. And I would envision the whole exchange, but it would be between two nuns. And for me, that just helped me feel like, oh, this has to do with me, because there's so many little ways that we get trapped in our identity view and tend to think like, this isn't mine. And so how do we work to break that down? So you could experiment with that. If you find that they feel like those are not my people, make them your people in whatever way. Make them you, really. The other thing I would sometimes experiment with is envisioning, you know, myself and my teacher having the exchange. Yeah, so the question needs to become our question. And Zhao Zhou asks, what is Tao? And so Tao is, you know, by now a word that we're probably used to hearing in the context of Zen teachings, but it's very much a word that Zen borrowed and kind of integrated into the teachings from, of course, Taoism. And so it means way. That's typically how it's translated. And some versions of this koan do translate Tao. And so it's ordinary mind is the way. That way being, you know, David Hinton calls it an ontological pathway. So a way that things exist, the way that things are, the way things transform, the way they reemerge, beingness. And so from that, like from within that, can we feel how when Zhao Zhou's asking this question, it's kind of like the question. The question. Like, what is the way? What is truth? What is reality? Like how we know for ourselves the live edge of our own spiritual question. It's like you want to fold that in there so it's as full and ripe. Because, of course, the reason that this exchange ends up being so pivotal for Zhao Zhou is because he's so full and ripe. That's what it takes. And this response, ordinary mind. So interestingly, I didn't realize this until I was working on this talk, but this is Matsu's teaching, ordinary mind. Nan Kuan studied with Matsu, and he brought this with him as an expression of the way. And so this is from the record of Master Matsu. The way needs no cultivation. Just do not defile. What is defilement? When with a mind of birth and death, one acts in a contrived way, then everything is defilement. With a mind of birth and death, right? So kind of the ordinary. If one wants to know the way directly, ordinary mind is the way. What is meant by ordinary mind? No activity, no right or wrong, no grasping or rejecting, neither terminable nor permanent, without worldly or holy. That's the ordinary mind we're talking about. And Nan Quan clarifies that later in the exchange. So the rest of that little, I shouldn't really use a diminutive here, the rest of this conversation is kind of like a pith instruction on how to sit, you guys. So Nan Quan says, ordinary mind is Tao, okay? And so here's Xiaozhou, and you can kind of feel him take that in, and it's like, okay, so now what am I supposed to do with that? Okay, so should I direct myself toward it or not? Like, you're saying it's ordinary, commonplace. The word heijo that's translated as ordinary is made up of two characters. One, hei, meaning simple, plain, common, ordinary, even, flat, level, and jo, meaning common, normal, frequent, regular, continual, always. And so together, ordinary, normal, everyday, usual. So this is the response, and so there's Xiaozhou, like, okay, well, so should I direct myself toward it or not? Like, what do I do with that? What do I do with that? It's like when Roshi the other day was saying again and again, like, the way is here. Okay, what do I do with that? Here. He said it multiple times. Here. Okay, I'm here. So do I need to do anything? I'm here. I don't feel I'm one with the way. Now what? And Nan Quan says, if you try to direct yourself toward it, you go away from it. So what is this telling us? That the kind of effort that we are maybe accustomed to expending is not the kind of effort that's needed. It's going to be a different kind of effort. If we're trying to get somewhere or get closer or improve something, these are all moving us further away, Nan Quan says. But we know that we have to do something. We have to do something, right? What do we do? What do we do? It's interesting too, because that in that exchange is like this like window into like the dualistic assumption of the student, right? Do I direct myself toward it? And the teacher trying to skillfully disrupt that dualistic assumption. If you direct yourself toward it, you move away from it. So don't direct yourself toward it. And then Xiaozhou continues, well, if we do not try, how can we know that it is Tao? Really great question. Okay, so now I'm not going to direct myself toward it. I'm not going to do anything. You're telling me it's here, it's ordinary mind, but like, I don't know that. How am I going to close that gap? How will I know? And Nan Quan replies, Tao does not belong to knowing or not knowing. Zen is rough. Nothing to hold on to. All the usual ways of solving a problem and using our mind aren't going to help us. Knowing is illusion. Not knowing is blankness. Knowing is illusion. So again, this is like that dualistic alert, right? When we know something, there's a knower and a thing that's known. And so we're not in the depths because there's two. Knowing is illusion. This is like so, we can see this and it's difficult, I think. It's very subtle. It's difficult to see. I'll say more about that. But for now, Nan Quan goes on, if you truly attain to the Tao of no doubt, it's like the great void, so vast and boundless. So here we also have to be careful. Because when these descriptions come in of like the void and things being vast and boundless, it's really easy to create a mental image and a concept in our mind of where we're headed and sneak back to trying to get there. We might not even realize that that's what we're doing. So vast and boundless and space, we got to throw away our ideas of what that means and just trust like those are pointing us to another quality of experience. And we can't go looking for it. We cannot go looking for it. So you just take it as a invitation maybe and put it down. So the way isn't something that we're going to know. It isn't something that we're going to figure out. And our measuring and knowing mind, the mind that assesses our practice and how we're doing, the mind that strategizes, that prepares, that, you know, raises us up high or brings us down low, that mind has to fall away. That's all like conditioned, right? And so if we think of ordinary as like stripped down and bare, like I'll just have an ordinary cup of coffee as opposed to like a pumpkin spice frappuccino or something. It's like ordinary like that, like nothing, no adornment. Your conditioned thoughts, your knowing mind, the measuring, judging, the strategizing, all of that is extra. So we have this like perfect practice to actually experience, to practice in this way. Zazen is like perfect. You would think it was kind of meant to do this. Because like, is there any better embodiment of like being here than Zazen? Like we're just sitting here. Is anyone confused about that part of it? No, right? It's like, you know, you have your seat, you go to your seat and you sit yourself down on it. And then you're going to be in your seat still for like half an hour. At the baseline, if we do nothing else, right, we're doing that. We're being here. And we've put everything else away So there's like no reading, there's no writing, there's no phones, there's no talking, there's like no other ways of distraction. So really, it is like, okay, just be here. Just be here. Roshi's been talking a lot about faith. I've been hearing him use that word quite a bit. And so this is like the faith that we need to be cultivating, the faith like in this practice of just being totally present. We might have like faith for a moment or two, but then we veer off. And some of that's just our conditioned mind like wants something. And some of it's because we actually think like, okay, I do need to get somewhere. I do need to get somewhere. There's only a couple of days of the session left, so I better like hurry it up. I can't remember if I shared this before, so bear with me if I have, but I'm in this peer group with some other Zen priests that we meet on Zoom once a month, and there's a priest who's in the group who trained in Japan for 30 years. He's now in his mid-70s. He's had so much experience. And we were sort of sharing how our various centers offer beginning instruction. And he said that he basically does what his teacher did back in Japan. And he studied with a teacher. It's a Harada, but it's not the Harada. It's Sekei Harada Roshi. At Hoshinji, which I know from my time in Japan has a very good reputation of being authentic training. And he said that his teacher's beginning instruction was, you sit down on the cushion and your practice is to warm the cushion. Like, you're not doing anything. You got that? You're not doing anything. It's like, wow, that is some hardcore beginning instruction. In the commentary, Mumon says, questioned by Zhao Zhou, Nanquan immediately shows that the tile is disintegrating, the ice is dissolving, and no communication whatsoever is possible. I love that. The tile is disintegrating and the ice is dissolving. Right? Where the tile and the ice. Daito Roshi used to like that line, no communication whatsoever is possible, because to communicate, you need two things. Must be the coffee. Nanquan had said, how then can there be right and wrong in the Tao? And so this is the sort of if we're to sort of understand the progression of the koan, that seems like maybe that's the turning word for Zhao Zhou. At these words, Zhao Zhou was suddenly enlightened. How can there be right and wrong in the Tao? Right? So Zhao Zhou's asking these questions: how do I know? How am I going to know how do I do it? How am I going to know if I get there? If I don't do this, how am I going to know? And Nanquan is saying, there's no knowing. It's so vast. It's so boundless. There's no right. There's no wrong. That sense of right and wrong, if we look carefully, we can see like that is really scaffolding our sense of self. It's the same as talking about grasping and aversion. Our sense of this and that, self and other, enough, not enough, good, bad, like all of these little ways of separating the sort of the tile and ice language, if you will. So what kind of effort does it take for all of that to drop away? Well, I think it's worth noting, like, we do so many things, actually, outside of the Zendo to train in this. And just how that, like, ordinary activity is so integral to how we practice and train, and that the instruction is, like, be intimate with what you're doing. Like, that's really deep teaching, you know? Just cut the carrot, just sweep the floor. And then the ways also that we will use liturgy in the forms of training here to reveal something that we might miss as, like, you know, that duality between sacred and mundane, to, like, hold that up. Like I was saying earlier, you know, like, we do that whole service before we clean the toilets, and we're invoking the Bodhisattva of compassion, and we're dedicating the merit to the benefit of all beings. And we're saying this activity is wondrous in its simplicity. Don't miss it. Right here in the midst of this very ordinary activity, something so profound is taking place. And same with Orioki. You know, the drum, that offering, it's so heightened. Like, on the one hand, we're just having breakfast, and on the other hand, like, whoa, this is how life is sustained. You take life to sustain your life, to fulfill your vows. Incredible. The soy milk so reverently held up. Don't miss it. And so this helps us to cultivate attention, paying attention, being here. Just like Roshi said, it's not going to happen someplace else. So let's really practice and train in being here. And trying to see, like, what does that mean? I feel like I'm present. Is there more? So just some other practice instructions. This is from Clarifying the Natural State, which is a very pithy meditation instruction from the Mahamudra tradition, where they also, interestingly, use this phrase. This is Dakpo Tashi Namyal. Meditation practice is known as undistracted ordinary mind. Ordinary mind simply means your mind's natural state. When you try to correct it by judging, accepting, or rejecting, it will no longer be your ordinary mind. Therefore, undistractedly maintain the natural state of your mind with a naturally aware presence. No matter what, no matter how it is or what is perceived or felt, that is simply meditating. Other than that, there isn't even as much as a hair tip to adjust mentally by meditating. It is explained in this way: while there isn't even as much as an atom to cultivate by meditating, you shouldn't be distracted for even as long as an instant. Phrased in another way, undistracted ordinary mind means to keep the way your mind naturally is without being distracted. Charlotte Joko Beck, in a talk that I listened to that she gave, talked about samadhi as total awareness that's not caught in your self-centered thoughts, not getting drawn in. And so we can have this notion that we need to obliterate all thinking and keep it that way. And that becomes a lot of effort. And now we're receiving this instruction on ordinary mind from reputable sources, I might add, on not adjusting, just be awake. don't get drawn in. It's difficult, but it's a game changer. The point is not to obliterate all our thoughts. So techniques and strategies that might lead to that end, like, I don't know. Our thoughts will come. The liberation is to see the nature of our thoughts, to not be fooled by them, to see them for what they are. All those thoughts are propping up you and me and this and that. And so as we begin to see through that, we begin to see through all those tiles. Hundreds of flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, and snow in winter. Things as they are. Perfect. If there is no vain cloud in your mind, for you it is a good season. And so when there is a vain cloud in our mind, a self-centered, preoccupied thought, to recognize that, not to let it stop you. Sometimes I think the little irritations that come up in Zazen are like the best, because you can really trust, it's okay to allow them and then see like what happens, right? The sound that's bugging you or, you know, whatever it is, if you can like make room and be like, okay, let me allow this and allow it into the sphere of perfect wonder and see what happened, like that we can, that it's our mind that's causing the irritation, that shows us something. So where do we enter? Here, of course. Where do we meet our ordinary mind? We're never apart from it. To just allow whatever divides us from this moment of our life to fall away, or we say, become intimate with it, bring it in close, become it. The sister of Naropa, Nyingma. Did you know Naropa had a sister? So cool. She's a Dakini. Some sources call her his consort, so I don't know, I guess there's a little ambiguity there. She's sometimes referred to as the dark Dakini, and she has a teaching, your mind is Dharmakaya. You could never be reunited with it, nor could you be separated from it. It is so close that you do not recognize it. It appears to you, yet it is so profound that you do not grasp it. It is so simple, you do not believe it.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.